So, where do we start? Good question.
I have
I
it
have.
marked at 216, page 216, but.
Yep, I also, yes. It is the
Is
supreme
this
will.
the truth that works?
Yeah.
If the truth of works, that's the beginning because I have different pages.
If this is the truth of works.
Yeah, perfect.
Now, the yoga of divine works, and the chapter 8 is su the supreme will.
Yes, but the paragraph is if this is
Ah, okay. Yeah, I see. That's right. It is the truth of works. Yeah. Does someone have the bell?
I
Something like
do.
that?
I
You
do.
do? Okay. Because I tried with my app, but it doesn't work properly. So
Here we
I
go.
do.
If this is the truth of works, the first thing the sadhaka has to do is to recoil from the egoistic forms of activity and get rid of the sense of an I that acts. He has to see and feel that everything happens in him by the plastic, conscious or subconscious or sometimes superconscious automatism of his mental and bodily instruments, moved by the forces of spiritual, mental, vital, and physical nature. There is a personality on his surface that chooses and wills, submits and struggles, tries to make good in nature or prevail over nature. But this personality is itself a construction of nature, and so dominated, driven, determined by her that it cannot be free. It is a formation or expression of the self in her. It is a self of nature rather than a self of self. His natural and processive, not his spiritual and permanent being. a temporary constructed personality, not the true immortal person. It is that person that he must become. He must succeed in being inwardly quiescent, detach himself as the observer from the outer active personality, and learn the play of the cosmic forces in him by standing back from all blinding absorption in its turns and movements. Thus, calm, detached, a student of himself and a witness of his nature, he realizes that he is the individual soul who observes the works of nature, accepts tranquilly her results and sanctions, or withholds his sanction from the impulse to her acts. At present, this soul, or Purusha, is little more than an acquiescent spectator, influencing perhaps the action and development of the being by the pressure of its veiled consciousness, but for the most part delegating its powers, or a fragment of them, to the outer personality, in fact, to nature, for this outer self is not Lord, but subject to her, Anisha. But once unveiled, it can make its sanction or refusal effective, become the master of the action, dictate sovereignly a change of nature. Even if for a long time, as the result of fixed association and past storage of energy, the habitual movement takes place independent of the Purusha's assent, and even if the sanctioned movement is persistently refused by nature for want of past habit, still he will discover that in the end his assent or refusal prevails. Slowly, with much resistance, or quickly, with a rapid accommodation of her means and tendencies, she modifies herself and her workings in the direction indicated by his inner sight or volition. Thus he learns, in place of mental control or egoistic will, an inner spiritual control which makes him master of the nature forces that work in him and not their unconscious instrument or mechanic slave. Above and around him is the Shakti, the universal mother, and from her he can get all his inmost soul needs and wills if only he has a true knowledge of her ways and a true surrender to the divine will in her. Finally, he becomes aware of that highest dynamic self within him and within nature, which is the source of all his seeing and knowing, the source of the sanction, the source of the acceptance, the source of the rejection. This is the Lord, the Supreme, the One in All, Ishvara Shakti, of whom his soul is a portion, a being of that being, and a power of that power. The rest of our progress depends on our knowledge of the ways in which the Lord of Works manifests his will in the world and in us, and executes them through the transcendent and universal Shakti. Quite a paragraph.
The Lord sees in his omniscience the thing that has to be done. The seeing is his will. It is a form of creative power, and that which he sees, the all-conscious mother, one with him, takes into her dynamic self and embodies an executive nature force, carries it out as the mechanism of their omnipotent omniscience. So let me read this sentence again. The Lord sees in his omniscience the thing that has to be done. The seeing is his will. It is a form of creative power. and that which he sees, the all-conscious mother, one with him, takes into her dynamic self and embodies and executive nature force carries it out as a mechanism of their omnipotent omniscience. But this vision of what is to be and therefore of what is to be done arises out of the very being, pours directly out of the consciousness and the light of existence of the Lord, spontaneously, like light from the sun. It is not our mortal attempt to see, our difficult arrival at truths of action and motive or just demand of nature. When the individual soul is entirely at one in its being and knowledge with the Lord, and directly in touch with the original Shakti, the transcendent mother, the supreme will can then arise in us to, in the, I'm sorry. When the individual soul is entirely at one in its being and knowledge with the Lord, and directly in touch with the original Shakti, the transcendent mother, the supreme will, can then arise in us too in the high and the high divine manner as a thing that must be and is achieved by the spontaneous action of nature. There is then no desire, no responsibility, no reaction. All takes place in the peace, calm, light, power of the supporting and enveloping and inhabiting divine.
But even before that highest approach to identity is achieved, something of the supreme will can manifest in us as an imperative impulsion, a God-driven action. We then act by a spontaneous self-determining force, but a fuller knowledge of meaning and aim arises only afterwards. Or the impulse to action may come as an inspiration or intuition, but rather in the heart and body than in the mind. Here, an effective sight enters in, but the complete and exact knowledge is still deferred and comes, if at all, later. But the divine will may descend too as a luminous single command or a total perception or a continuous current of perception of what is to be done into the will or into the thought, or as a direction from above spontaneously fulfilled by the lower members. When the yoga is imperfect, only some actions can be done in this way, or else a general action may so proceed, but only during periods of exaltation and illumination. When the yoga is perfect, all action becomes of this character. We may indeed distinguish three stages of a growing process, by which first the personal will is occasionally or frequently enlightened or moved by a supreme will, a conscious force beyond it, then constantly replaced, and last identified and merged in that divine power action. The first is the stage when we are still governed by the intellect, heart, and senses. These have to seek or wait for the divine inspiration and guidance, do not always find or receive it. The second is the stage when human intelligence is more and more replaced by a high, illumined, or intuitive spiritual mind, spiritualized mind, the external human heart by the inner psychic heart, the senses by a purified and selfless vital force. The third is the stage when we rise above spiritualized mind to the supramental levels.
In all three stages, the fundamental character of the liberated action is the same. A spontaneous working of prakriti, no longer through or for the ego, but at the will and for the enjoyment of the supreme Purusha. At a higher level, this becomes the truth of the absolute and universal supreme expressed through the individual soul, and worked out consciously through the nature, no longer through a half-perception and a diminished or distorted effectuation by the stumbling, ignorant, and all-deforming energy of lower nature in us, but by the all-wise, transcendent, and universal Mother.
Do you have a new paragraph here? Because mine continues.
Yes.
Okay. new paragraph starts with "the Lord has veiled himself."
Okay, I'll mark that. The Lord has veiled himself and his absolute wisdom and eternal consciousness in ignorant nature force and suffers her to drive the individual being with its complicity as the ego. This lower action of nature continues to prevail, often in spite of man's half-lit, imperfect efforts at a nobler motive and a purer self-knowledge. Our human effort at perfection fails or progresses very incompletely, owing to the force of nature's past actions in us, her past formations, her long-rooted associations. It turns toward a true and high-climbing success only when a greater knowledge or power than our own breaks through the lid of our ignorance and guides or takes up our personal will. For our human will is a misled and wandering ray that has parted from the supreme puissance. The period of slow emergence out of this lower working into a higher light and purer force is the valley of the shadow of death for the striver after perfection. It is a dreadful passage full of trials, sufferings, sorrows, obscurations, stumblings, errors, pitfalls. To abridge and alleviate this ordeal, or to penetrate it with a divine delight, faith is necessary. An increasing surrender of the mind to the knowledge that imposes itself from within, and above all, a true aspiration and a right and unfaltering and sincere practice. Practice unfalteringly, says the Gita, with a heart free from despondency, the yoga. For even though in the earlier stage of the path we drink deep of the bitter poison of internal discord and suffering, the last taste of this cup is the sweetness of the nectar of immortality and the honey wine of an eternal Ananda. Well, there's in one line pretty much a lifetime of of the work. Wow.
I like this chapter because it promises you something. It's not just philosophy. It's like someone who is showing you the cake. Say, do you want it? You have to do something about it if you want to have it. Huh? It's sort of, but very inspiring. Because it tells something about the future, I would say, also. At least a part of humanity. I don't know if it, you know.
Yeah, I found it very beautiful and inspiring, this section that we read this today.
But I like also this idea, supreme will, and he confronts it, he makes a comparison, he compares it with our human idea of free will. Do we have free will or not? This is a returning topic and theme. And I think he offers a solution that I didn't find nowhere else. Because usually people say yes or no. There's this black and white option where he says neither nor. He says that we are not free, but we can become free. And that's right. a third option, a third possibility that rarely I find people consider this a possibility. Yeah.
That was a blessing for me when I became addicted at one point. And then about 15 years ago, I went into recovery. And there, because our will has been completely hijacked by the addiction, I mean, really thoroughly hijacked, you cannot trust your own mind anymore. And it was a great blessing for me. And I realized how deeply that was a part of the integral yoga, to not trust your own thinking or will or feelings. I mean, not that that doesn't need to pay, that we don't need to pay attention to it, we do, but that it is not free, that because we are a slave to whatever has moved us from the past and how we are put together in our personality. And so here is a very clear description that if we, the more we can surrender to this higher self in us, the more free we actually become. And this is one of those beautiful seeming contradictions. Yeah.
Then he says also it needs faith, but not blind faith.
Yeah.
Or yes, in a certain sense, it is a blind faith, but it is not a dogmatic faith. It's not a faith from the mind. It's a faith from the heart. I don't know. If it, in a certain sense, it is also a blind faith, but not in the sense that people mean. But in any case, if you don't have faith, I think the surrender is almost impossible. I don't know. Because it's like walking towards a black hole, so to speak. And you come near and near and near and have faith that nothing happens, so to speak. Because your mind tells you that something is dangerous, perhaps, or you shouldn't do it, or you should hurry and do something and stress out and get burnout to reach something. And when, that's my experience at least, sometimes I say, okay, it should happen what it should happen. And then things organize and arrange itself automatically, almost automatically. And I said, all that stress for nothing. If I would have had more faith, things would have turned out much better and organized much better than the mind tells us. So it's a sort of, but it's not a religious faith. I don't know how to define it. It's a bit different.
I would like to respond to that, Marco, mm-hmm. because the beauty of this is not like having faith in some God out there.
Mm.
This is the Purusha and the Shakti in ourselves. It is inside of us. It's,
yeah.
It's not foreign to us. It's actually our true self. It's when all this stuff gets quieted down and we can become silent and listen to a deeper place within us.
Exactly.
That which is, for me, what faith is. You know, I mean, faith can be described in many ways. But I think there's a lot of confusion especially because of the Christianity, the faith is placed outside of us.
Mm.
You know, there is this God somewhere that you hope to be pleasing to. But this is like you find the truth within you. Like Mother Aurobindo said very clearly, we don't want followers. You find the truth inside of yourself and you follow that.
Mm. Exactly, yeah.
It's inside of us already.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's all right.
But it's also true, it's both are true. It says something in us, but that something in us, I don't like to call it God, I like to call it divine, as Sri Aurobindo does, is the divine. It is in us the divine. So it is still a faith in the divine, but yes, it's not out there. An old man with a beard on the throne, obviously not. I don't think that nobody believes that, but it is something in us, and we are that, with a capital letter T, capital T.
Yeah.
I don't think having faith in the divine, also Jewish call it God, is substantially wrong, provided that we understand that it is in us and we are an emanation, so to speak, of it. Yeah. And then if you have faith, yeah. Maybe the point is the other way around. Stop having faith in our mind. Then the true faith emerges automatically. That's how I feel it. Because there is always this instinct, especially I think in intellectual persons, to follow rationality, pure logic. And sometimes the right thing to do is not rational, is not logic at all. And that's hard, not to listen at that part of ourselves, at least for me. Maybe for other people, it's a question of character, probably. For many people, it's much easier.
So Sri Aurobindo actually really talks about this divine impulse being logical, that actually it is that. Is never, if it contradicts logic, it's probably wrong. There's a deep logic in the higher wisdom.
Yeah, but it's not the human logic. It's not the logic of the mind. It's a divine logic, so to speak, yeah. But let me make an example that is probably very typical nowadays. You have to pay the bills, and you're running out of money. If you make your calculations, you will not do it for the end of the month. That's very logical. It's math. And yet, if you have faith, something happens and you don't run into problems. So there's some other logic in our universe is active, and that derealizes a mental, purely mental human logic. And that's what I mean. Of course, it doesn't mean that we have to do senseless things, and we should, of course, have discrimination. The most powerful thing of the mind is the ability to discriminate, but not so much in making a prediction, at least not my mind. I don't know about you, but when I make predictions, it's mostly wrong. And I think I reason very logically in the human sense. But you see that things happen that do not follow this rational, purely rational logic that we call logic in science, for example, or in our everyday meaning. But yeah, that's a bit of a play of words, I don't know.
Shall we read this section again? Or did we read it last time too?
I want to say something about in this conversation too. I'm glad, Andrea, that you brought up the point about how this supreme, this Lord that he's talking about, is not something other. And I think, my mind has the habit of when I hear that, hear the Lord or the Supreme has the habit, kind of automatic habit of assuming that that's someone else. So I notice that Sri Aurobindo in this passage, I don't remember exactly where it is, he makes that point. He just makes it briefly in passing, that it's not somebody else. Or we could say it's both. But anyway, the other thing I wanted to say was that sometimes when you have an experience of light or of something that's beyond, that seems like it's from the divine or from some heavenly being, it's an odd thing that it seems very familiar because it contradicts that automatic assumption that it's something else. And yet, I mean, one can be very startled or amazed and all that, but there's also this sense, wow, this feels familiar. And then you go back to the other ordinary consciousness, you know, and back to the all the fragmentation. But I think that's really interesting, that the familiarity of the experience of some higher force like that.
So I also wanted to say something, but I'm not sure whether I should or not. Because these are like some of my bees in my bonnets. You know, so first of all, I don't think of rational and logical as the same thing at all. I know when I grew up, they were more or less synonyms, but I think our understanding of cognition and the world and has evolved. And today, I don't think we see them as necessarily. I mean, maybe some people still do see them as the same, but you know, the studies of you know, Damasio's work on cognition and so forth and emotion has shown that if you don't have emotion, you cannot reason through logical chains. You cannot do it without the emotion. So, because the emotion is the judgment that allows you to make sense of one logical statement versus another. You can't do that without the emotion. So to put logical and rational together and on one side and emotion on the other side makes no sense at all. The rational includes the emotive. And the logic is purely formal chains of things. Without the emotional, you're lost. So when Aurobindo calls his work logical, I mean, as long as it's consistent, it's logical in sense, because logic is linked to the idea of consistency. Now, I actually don't like consistency for other reasons, but so another B. And then the other B I have in the bonnet, of course, is this idea that, I mean, okay, Christianity does have this idea of the God as another, but it also has this idea of the God as the self. I mean, all of the deep Christian people I know think of God as inside themselves. They may also think of God as an outside identity. It's part of the paradoxes of that kind of faith, that God is both inside and outside the self, but that's not that different from what we're talking about here. So I know, you know, we have an ongoing discussion about it, but I am loath to oversimplify what goes on in the Christian world in terms of these understanding of things. I think it's easy to caricaturize it. And I think the issues aren't there. They're not outside versus inside. They're in something about the way the divine is structured in the thinking in rather complex ways that aren't easy to you know, to work out. But clearly, the Aurobindo program is different from that. So, I mean, we don't have any disagreements there. It's just that I'm a little bit, I try to be a bit more careful in how I talk about our religions, whether it's Christianity or some other religion. What else did I had? I had another thing. Anyway, maybe I'll stop there and try to remember the other thing.
Yeah, well, I appreciate how you have that so clearly in your awareness. I find it rather easy to talk about Christianity, and then I'm not talking about mystical Christianity. I'm just talking about the system, the church, the formation, the rules and regulations, and how to keep the people under control. So I'm totally, I know that Christian mysticism is absolutely gorgeous and very internal.
Yeah. In fact, it reminds me of Meister Eckhart. I don't know if you know, it's a mystic of, I don't know, when was it? In the 13th century. And he said, all things are God itself, and God is in us. Nature that creates but is not created. He had very similar views of, and he also spoke of this discipline of detachment that also Sri Aurobindo is speaking about. He was probably a sort of Western Christian yogi. So there are a lot of mystics, I think, that indeed recognize the God within. It is not something alien to the Christian tradition, yes, of course.
I remembered the other thing. interesting enough, ironically enough, the question is the question of the other, or not just the other thing, but the other. Because, so there again, I'm a little bit, I'm trying... I'm sort of sensitive to this, to the argument of simplification, because when we're dealing with the divine, I should rephrase that. When we're dealing with the other, there's a way where we have to recognize the possibility of otherness. If everything becomes, because the alternative is everything becomes self. And if everything is self, there is no new anything in the world except oneself. Otherness is the possibility of something new, something else that exists. And so we have this sort of equilibrium between otherness and sameness, right? So God, the divine for me, is both familiar and other. And if you just focus on the familiar, you lose a key part of the whole puzzle. Just as if you focused on the other, you would lose a key part of the puzzle. So I do think this sensitivity to issues of other is really, really important in today's world, where there's so much intolerance that comes from an inability to accept the other, even in our own lives, or in, you know, there's this ongoing tension between otherness and familiarity. So anyway, another one of my bees in my bonnet.
Jeffrey, you're practically a hive today.
But lots of honey.
Yeah, but lots of bonnets too. So,
yeah.
So should we go towards chapter 9? What about?
Or read the same section one more time.
Or read the section one more time.
I would kind of like that.
To reread.
How about the other two? Any preference?
You're talking at the next chapter. It's about 11 pages. So it's a chunk. So maybe rereading makes good sense for today and then tackle the next chapter the next time. No.
I don't have a strong preference, but rereading is okay.
It's okay.
But we're just reading the section we read today. We're not going back to the beginning of the chapter.
Right.
Okay.
So who's starting? I don't want to start so that we have different things to read.
Yeah, in fact, so I start because that the next was me and you started with this paragraph. So, it's so long.
Yeah, this is very, very long. It's almost two pages.
if you want something, I don't mind.
So then, let's make that. Oops, sorry. Let's make that. Geoffrey, if you are so kind, take my part, and we go counterclockwise. Then, and then John Robert, and then me, because I already read this.
Oh yes.
Paragraph 15.
Good idea.
So that I skip that part. So, Geoffrey, John Robert, me, and Andrea.
Okay. If this is the truth of works, the first thing the sadhaka has to do is to recoil from the egoistic forms of activity and get rid of the sense of an I that acts. He has to see and feel that everything happens in him by the plastic conscious or subconscious, or sometimes superconscious automatism of his mental and bodily instruments, moved by the forces of the spiritual, mental, vital, and physical nature. There is a personality on his surface that chooses and wills, submits and struggles, tries to make good in nature or prevail over nature. But this personality is itself a construction of nature, and so dominated, driven, determined by her, that it cannot be free. It is a formation or expression of the self in her. It is a self of nature rather than a self of self. His natural and processive, not his spiritual and permanent being. A temporary constructed personality, not the true immortal person. It is that person that he must become. He must succeed in being inwardly quiescent, detach himself as the observer from the outer active personality, and learn the play of the cosmic forces in him by standing back from all the binding absorption in its turn and movement. So I love that. Sorry, I'm going to do that again. He must succeed in being inwardly quiescent, detach himself as the observer from the outer active personality, and learn the play of the cosmic forces in him by standing back from all blinding absorption in its turns and movements. Thus, calm, detached, a student of himself and a witness of his nature, he realizes that he is the individual soul who observes the work of nature, accepts tranquilly her results, and sanctions or withholds his sanction from the impulse to her acts. At present, this soul or Purusha is little more than an acquiescent spectator, influencing perhaps the action and development of the being by the pressure of its veiled consciousness, but for the most part delegating its powers or a fragment of them to the outer personality. In fact, to nature, for this outer self is not Lord, but subject to her, anisa. But once unveiled, it can make its sanction or refusal effective, become the master of the action, dictate sovereignly a change of nature. Even if for a long time, as the result of fixed association and past storage of energy, the habitual movement takes place independent of the Purusha's assent, and even if the sanctioned movement is persistently refused by nature for want of past habit, still he will discover that in the end his assent or refusal prevails. Slowly, with much resistance, or quickly, with a rapid accommodation of her means and tendencies, she modifies herself and her workings in the direction indicated by his inner sight or volition. She is nature here, is that, I got that right? Thus he learns in place a mental control or egoistic will, an inner spiritual control which makes him master of the nature forces at work in him and not their unconscious instrument or mechanical slave. Above and around him is the Shakti, the Universal Mother, and from her he can get all his inmost soul needs and wills, if only he has a true knowledge of her ways and a true surrender to the divine will in her. Finally, he becomes aware of that highest dynamic self within him and within nature, which is the source of all his seeing and knowing, the source of the sanction, the source of the acceptance, the source of the rejection. This is the Lord, the Supreme, the One in All, Ishvara Shakti, Shakti, of whom his soul is a portion, a being of that being, and a power of that power. The rest of our progress depends on our knowledge of the ways in which the Lord of Works manifests his will in the world and in us and executes them through the transcendent and universal Shakti. I get what you mean about it being a heavy paragraph, Andrea.
The Lord sees in his omniscience the thing that has to be done. This seeing is his will. It is a form of creative power. And that which he sees, the all-conscious mother, one with him, takes into her dynamic self and embodies. An executive nature force carries it out as the mechanism of their omnipotent omniscience. But this vision of what is to be, and therefore of what is to be done, arises out of the very being, pours directly out of the consciousness and delight of existence of the Lord spontaneously, like light from the sun. It is not our mortal attempt to see, our difficult arrival at truth of action and motive, or just demand of nature. When the individual soul is entirely at one in its being and knowledge with the Lord, and directly in touch with the original Shakti, the Transcendent Mother, the Supreme Will can then arise in us too, in the high divine manner, as a thing that must be and is achieved by the spontaneous action of nature. There is then no desire, no responsibility, no reaction. All takes place in the peace, calm, light, power of the supporting and enveloping and inhabiting divine.
But even before that highest approach to identity is achieved, something of the Supreme Will can manifest in us as an imperative impulsion, a God-driven action. We then act by a spontaneous self-determining force, but a fuller knowledge of meaning and aim arises only afterwards. Or the impulse to action may come as an inspiration or intuition, but rather in the heart and body than in the mind. Here, an effective sight enters in but the complete and exact knowledge is still deferred and comes, if at all, later. But the divine will may descend too as a luminous single command or a total perception or a continuous current of perception of what is to be done into the will or into the thought, or as a direction from above spontaneously fulfilled by the lower members. When the yoga is imperfect, only some actions can be done in this way, or else a general action may so proceed, but only during periods of exaltation and illumination. When the yoga is perfect, all action becomes of this character. We may indeed distinguish three stages of a growing progress by which, first, the personal will is occasionally or frequently enlightened or moved by a supreme will or conscious force beyond it, then constantly replaced and, last, identified and merged in that divine power action. The first is the stage when we are still governed by the intellect, heart, and senses. These have to seek or wait for the divine inspiration and guidance and do not always find or receive it. The second is the stage when human intelligence is more and more replaced by a high illumined or intuitive spiritualized mind, the external human heart by the inner psychic heart, the senses by a purified and selfless vital force. The third is a stage when we rise even above spiritualized mind to the supramental levels.
In all three stages, the fundamental character of the liberated action is the same. A spontaneous working of prakriti no longer through or for the ego, but at the will and for the enjoyment of the supreme purusha. At a higher level, this becomes the truth of the absolute and universal supreme, expressed through the individual soul and worked out consciously through the nature. No longer through a half perception and a diminished or distorted effectuation by the stumbling, ignorant, and all deforming energy of lower nature in us, but by the all-wise, transcendent, and universal mother.
The Lord has veiled himself and his absolute wisdom and eternal consciousness in ignorant nature force and suffers her to drive the individual being with its complicity as the ego. This lower action of nature continues to prevail, often even in spite of man's half-lit imperfect efforts at a nobler motive and a purer self-knowledge. Our human effort at perfection fails or progresses very incompletely, owing to the force of nature's past actions in us, her past formations, her long-rooted associations. It turns towards a true and high-climbing success only when a greater knowledge and power than our own breaks through the lid of our ignorance and guides or takes up our personal will. For our human will is a misled and wandering ray that has parted from the supreme puissance. The period of slow emergence out of this lower working into a higher light and pure force is the valley of the shadow of death for the striver after perfection. It is a dreadful passage full of trials, sufferings, sorrows, obscurations, stumblings, errors, pitfalls. To abridge and alleviate this ordeal or to penetrate it with a divine delight, faith is necessary. An increasing surrender of the mind to the knowledge that imposes itself from within, and above all, a true aspiration and a right and unfaltering and sincere practice. Practice unfalteringly, says the Gita, with a heart free from despondency, the yoga. For even though in the early stage of the path we drink deep of the bitter poison of internal discord and suffering, the last taste of this cup is the sweetness of the nectar of immortality and the honey wine of an eternal ananda.
I read now an increasing surrender of the mind. I didn't notice this previously. So I feel assured. I thought it was only my theory. So great to know. So further comments? Or should we proceed, or should we stop here?
I have a comment. Yeah. I really appreciated the passages, the passage on the top of this last page, where he talks about the valley of the shadow of death. It is a dreadful passage full of trials, suffering, sorrows, and so on. I really appreciated Sri Aurobindo for acknowledging that in such vivid terms. He went through it himself, and so did Mother.
This is also something that you have in Christianity, no? The night of the souls. I don't remember now.
Yeah, well, it's Psalm 23, is it? The Valley of the Shadow of Death. Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking of reference to the Psalms there also.
And what do they see?
Say, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will be a good one. I don't remember it all, but I do remember that passage.
Yeah, but there was also a mystic, a famous mystic who spoke about them. I remember it as the night of the soul or something like that.
St. John of the Cross talked like that.
Yeah, exactly.
I think most mystics have gone through what they call a night of the soul.
The dark night of the soul, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, exactly so. Yeah.
Because we have to go down if we want to go up. You can't go up and not go down.
Yeah.
<It has to.
laughs> So above and as above, so below, or so below as above. So also the ancient Greece said that. No? I don't remember now who was saying that. But. And Mother also says once, I don't know if you read this passage of the agenda, and she said, I have gone down, 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 deep, deep, deep in the inconscient, and then suddenly, like a spring, a powerful light sprang out from this unconscious. At the bottom of the pit, you find the highest spiritual light, so to speak. Again, my words. It's better that you read this by your own. That I think what was more or less a meaning. Yeah, it's a universal law. Interesting. And yet, they said there is a sunlit path. They said it is not necessary to suffer in order to evolve. Good news.
They also said we love our suffering.
Yeah.
So I'm happy to keep on reading into the next section if you want. I mean, we're still early, so for...
I kind of thought we would be done for today. But I suppose I can turn my mind around again.
Well, there's two pages and then a break.
Okay.
And then another three pages in the break, so we can decide where we want to stop. But
if we go next to the first two sections, we are in the middle of the chapter. Could be. First two sections. Okay.
So
four. Who was the last reading?
I was last, so John Robert could go. Yeah. We follow the same order we're on now, but.
Chapter 9, Equality and the Annihilation of Ego. An entire self-consecration, a complete equality, an unsparing effacement of the ego, a transforming deliverance of the nature from its ignorant modes of action, are the steps by which the surrender of all the being and nature to the divine will can be prepared and achieved. A self-giving, true, total, and without reserve. The first necessity is an entire spirit of self-consecration in our works. It must become first the constant will, then the ingrained need in all the being. Finally, its automatic but living and conscious habit, the self-existent turn to do all action as a sacrifice to the Supreme and to the veiled power present in us and in all beings and in all the workings of the universe. Life is the altar of this sacrifice. Works are our offering. A transcendent and universal power and presence, as yet rather felt or glimpsed than known or seen by us, is the deity to whom they are offered. This sacrifice, this self-consecration, has two sides to it. There is the work itself, and there is the spirit in which it is done, the spirit of worship to the master of works in all that we see, think, and experience.
The work itself is at first determined by the best light we can command in our ignorance. It is that which we conceive the thing that should be done. And whether it be shaped by our sense of duty, by our feeling for our fellow creatures, by our ideas of what is for the good and whether it be shaped by our sense of duty, by our feeling for our fellow creatures, by our idea of what is for the good of others or the good of the world, or by the direction of one whom we accept as a human master, wiser than ourselves, and for us the representative of that Lord of all works in whom we believe, but whom we do not yet know, the principle is the same. The essential of the sacrifice of works must be there, and the essential is the surrender of all desire for the fruit of works, the renunciation of all attachment to the result for which yet we labor. For so long as we work with the attachment to the result, the sacrifice is offered not to the divine, but to our ego. We may think otherwise, but we are deceiving ourselves. We are making our idea of the divine, our sense of duty, our feeling for our fellow creatures, our idea of what is good for the world or others, even our obedience to the master, a mask for our egoistic satisfaction and preferences, and a spacious shield against the demand made on us to root all desire out of our nature.
You added your mute, you were unmuted, Andrea, and there was an echo, and now then you muted yourself to speak. So
I guess I missed that moment. Thank you. At this stage of the yoga, and even throughout the yoga, this form of desire, this figure of the ego, is the enemy against whom we have to be always on our guard with an unsleeping vigilance. We find him lurking within us and assuming all sorts of disguises. But we should be vigilant to detect him in all his masks and inexorable in expelling his influence. The illumining word of this movement is the decisive line of the Gita: to action thou hast a right, but never under any circumstances to its fruit. The fruit belongs solely to the Lord of all works. Our only business with it is to prepare the success by a true and careful action and to offer it, if it comes, to the Divine Master. Afterwards, even as we have renounced attachment to the fruit, we must renounce attachment to the work. At any moment, we must be prepared to change one work, one course, or one field of action for another, or abandon all works if that is the clear command of the Master. Otherwise, we do the act not for his sake, but for our satisfaction and pleasure in the work, from the kinetic nature's need of action, or for the fulfillment of our propensities. But these are all stations and refuges of the ego. However necessary for our ordinary motion of life, they have to be abandoned in the growth of the spiritual consciousness and replaced by divine counterparts. Ananda, an impersonal and God-directed delight, will cast out or supplant the unillumined vital satisfaction and pleasure, a joyful driving of the divine energy, the kinetic need. The fulfillment of the propensities will no longer be an object or a necessity. There will be instead the fulfillment of the divine will through the natural dynamic truth in action of a free soul and a luminous nature. In the end, as the attachment to the fruit of the work and to the work itself has been excised from the heart, so also the last clinging attachment to the idea and sense of ourselves as a doer has to be relinquished. The divine Shakti must be known and felt above and within us as the true and sole worker.
So there's a break here. Does anybody want to make any comments? No, you're muted again, Andrea.
It's a big job. That's what I wanted to say. Now I'm going to mute myself.
I do love this thing. To action thou hast a right, but never under any circumstances to its fruit. I think that's an interesting insight. Should I go on?
Just quickly, also money. If you get money, do you do that? If you work for money, you give it to the divine. Where is its bank account? Yeah, it's difficult. It's not that easy to understand. It's not my money. But okay.
I don't know that that's what it's saying exactly. Mm. I think that's quite what it is. It's not. It's a giving it up in your heart. It's not a. It's a different thing.
Yeah, but when I do a hard job and earn some money, the fruit is not mine. What does it mean in practical terms in this case, in such a very pragmatic and I think realistic case?
Well, I think he's talking like if you do something for a charitable purpose, for instance, or if you're doing something in the view of helping the world or helping the larger divine will or whatever, let it go. Let it go. Once you put it into place, let it go. Don't get hung up on the results, whatever they are. The results that gets you stuck into the ego, hung up again on things, right? And so it's a letting go. It's a demand to let things go. That's the way I understand it. I don't know what the others think.
Yeah, sure. But I was thinking at a very specific case, yeah? Because in our world, everything is quantified in with that thing that we call money. And it is a number in a bank account. And when he says the fruit belongs solely to the Lord of all works, in practical terms, what does it mean?
Money is not a thing, it's a symbol. It's a replacement for something else. So it's not a thing.
If you read in the little booklet that Sherbendo wrote, it's called The Mother. There is a whole section on money.
Yeah.
And money is also a force that belongs to the mother.
Yeah.
So you can make money. Of course, we make money. But then in ourselves, we can also offer that to her. And be grateful.
Okay. Yeah.
That it's not mine. It's like to get this grabbing of the ego out of it.
You offer it, of course.
Yeah.
But it's easy. It doesn't mean you're going to say, I'm going to give away all my money and then I'm going to live on that. Makes sense. It's not the absolute give it all up. It's this
It's given to you to manage in a higher consciousness if you can.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean giving it all up, and it doesn't mean keeping it all either. It doesn't mean one of those. It means it's now belongs to the Lord or the mother, and to the extent that you can, if your sacrifice is sincere, you do with that as you are guided. To the extent that you receive guidance, you have to do with it as you're guided to do with it. And so if your sincerity is perfect, then you do whatever that your inner guidance tells you. And if it's not, it's a partial sacrifice, a stage on the way.
Absolutely. Thank you for the clarification.
So should I go on to read? The renunciation of attachment to the work and its fruit is the beginning of a wide movement towards an absolute equality in the mind and soul, which must become all-enveloping if we are to be perfect in the spirit. For the worship of the Master of Works demands a clear recognition and glad acknowledgement of him in ourselves, in all things, and in all happenings. Equality is the sign of this adoration. It is the soul's ground on which true sacrifice and worship can be done. The Lord is there equally in all beings. We have to make no essential distinctions between ourselves and others, the wise and the ignorant, friend and enemy, man and animal, the saint and the sinner. We must hate none, despise none, be repelled by none. For in all we have to see the one disguised and manifested at his pleasure. He is a little revealed in one and more revealed in another, or concealed and wholly distorted in others, according to his will and his knowledge of what is best for that which he intends to become in form in them and to do in works in their nature. All is ourself, one self that has taken many shapes. Hatred and disliking and scorn and repulsion, clinging and attachment and preference are natural, necessary, inevitable at a certain stage. They attend upon or they help to make and maintain nature's choice in us. But to the karma yogin, they are a survival, a stumbling block, a process of the ignorance. And as he progresses, they fall away from his nature. The child's soul needs them for its growth, but they drop from an adult in the divine culture. In the God nature to which we have to rise, there can be an adamantine, even a destructive severity, but not hatred, a divine irony, but not scorn, a calm, clear-seeing, and forceful rejection, but not repulsion and dislike. Even what we have to destroy, you must not abhor or fail to recognize as a disguised and temporary movement of the eternal.
And since all things are the one self in its manifestation, we shall have equality of soul towards the ugly and the beautiful, the maimed and the perfect, the noble and the vulgar, the pleasant and the unpleasant, the good and the evil. Here also there will be no hatred, scorn, and repulsion, but instead the equal eye that sees all things in their real character and their appointed place. For we shall know that all things express or disguise, develop or distort, as best they can, or with whatever defect they must, under the circumstances intended for them, in the way possible to the immediate status or function or evolution of their nature, some truth or fact, some energy or potential of the divine necessary by its presence in the progressive manifestation, both to the whole of the present sum of things and for the perfection of the ultimate result. That truth is what we seek and discover behind the transitory expression. Undeterred by appearances, by the deficiencies or the disfigurements of the expression, we can then worship the divine, forever unsullied, pure, beautiful, and perfect behind his masks. All indeed has to be changed, not ugliness accepted, but divine beauty, not imperfection taken as our resting place, but perfection striven after. The supreme good made the universal aim and not evil. But what we do has to be done with a spiritual understanding and knowledge. And it is a divine good, beauty, perfection, pleasure that has to be followed after, not the human standards of these things. If we have not equality, it is a sign that we are still pursued by the ignorance. We shall truly understand nothing, and it is more than likely that we shall destroy the old imperfection only to create another, for we are substituting the appreciations of our human mind and desire soul for the divine values.
Equality does not mean a fresh ignorance or blindness. It does not call for and need not initiate a grayness of vision and a blotting out of all hues. Difference is there, variation of expression is there, and this variation we shall appreciate far more justly than we could when the eye was clouded by a partial and erring love and hate, admiration and scorn, sympathy and antipathy. Attraction and repulsion. But behind the variation, we shall always see the complete and immutable who dwells within it, and we shall feel, know, or at least if it is hidden from us, trust in the wise purpose and divine necessity of the particular manifestation, whether it appear to our human standards harmonious and perfect or crude and unfinished, or even false and evil.
And so too, we shall have the same equality of mind and soul towards all happenings, painful or pleasurable, defeat and success, honor and disgrace, good repute and ill repute, good fortune and even evil fortune. For in all happenings, we shall see the will of the master of all works and results and a step in the evolving expression of the divine. He manifests himself to those who have the inner eye that sees, enforces, and their play and results, as well as in things and in creatures. All things move towards a divine event. Each experience, suffering, and want no less than joy and satisfaction is a necessary link in the carrying out of a universal movement, which it is our business to understand and second. To revolt, to condemn, to cry out is the impulse of our unchastened and ignorant instincts. Revolt, like everything else, has its uses in the play and is even necessary, helpful, decreed for the divine development in its own time and stage. But the movement of an ignorant rebellion belongs to the stage of the soul's childhood or to its raw adolescence. The ripened soul does not condemn, but seeks to understand and master, does not cry out, but accepts or toils to improve and perfect, does not revolt inwardly, but labors to obey and fulfill and transfigure. Therefore, we shall receive all things with an equal soul from the hands of the Master. Failure we shall admit as a passage, as calmly as success, until the hour of the divine victory arrives. Our souls and minds and bodies will remain unshaken by acutest sorrow and suffering and pain if in the divine dispensation they come to us, unoverpowered by intensest joy and pleasure. I'll read that line again. Our souls and minds and bodies will remain unshaken by acute sorrow and suffering pain if in the divine dispensation they come to us, unoverpowered by intensest joy and pleasure. Thus, supremely balanced, we shall continue steadily on our way, meeting all things with an equal calm until we are ready for a more exalted status and can enter into the supreme and universal Ananda.
So I think that's a good place to stop for today. I don't know how you feel about that, but it's the next chunk, 4 pages, another 3 pages.
Yes. So we made another piece.
This is good stuff.
Good stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I like this. I mean, it's all good, but this speaks to me directly.
Okay. Thank you very much to all. There are no other comments.
We have a few minutes of meditation.
Meditation, sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Namaste.
Namaste.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Good to read with you. Bye-bye.